Welcome to a half hour of Mind Webs. Short stories from the worlds of speculative fiction. This story was originally copyrighted in 1955 by Fantasy House. It's Damon Knight's The Country of the Kind. The attendant at the car lot was daydreaming when I pulled up, a big, lazy-looking man in black satin checkered down the front. I was wearing scarlet myself. It suited my mood. I got out, almost on his toes. He asked, "Parker Storage," turning around. Then he realized who I was and ducked his head away. I told him, "Neither." There was a hand torch on a shelf in the repair shed right behind him. I got it and came back. I knelt down to where I could reach behind the front wheel and ignited the torch. I turned it on the axle and suspension. They glowed cherry red and then white and then fused together. Then I got up and turned the flame on both tires until the rubberoid stank and sizzled and melted down to the pavement. The attendant didn't say anything. I left him there looking at the mess on his nice clean concrete. It had been a nice car, too, but I could get another one any time. And I felt like walking. I went down the winding road, sleepy in the afternoon sunlight, dappled with shade and smelling of cool leaves. You couldn't see the houses. They were all sunken or hidden by shrubbery or a little of both. That was a fad I'd heard about. It was what I'd come here to see. Not that anything the dolls did would be worth looking at. I turned off at random and crossed a rolling lawn, went through a second hedge of hawthorn and blossom and came out next to a big, sunken games court. The tennis net was up and two couples were going at it, just working up a little sweat, young, about half my age, all four of them. Three dark-haired and a blonde. They were evenly matched, and both couples played well together. They were enjoying themselves. I watched for a minute, but by then the nearest two were beginning to sense I was there anyhow. I walked down onto the court, just as the blonde was about to serve. She looked at me, frozen across the net, poised on tiptoe. The others stood. I told them, "Off. Game's over." I watched the blonde. She was not especially pretty as they go, but compactly and gracefully put together. She came down slowly, flat-footed, without awkwardness, and tucked the racket under her arm. Then the surprise was over, and she was trotting off the court after the other three. I followed their voices around the curve of the path between towering masses of lilacs, inhaling the sweetness until I came to what looked like a little sunning spot. There was a sundial and a birdbath and towels lying around on the grass, and one couple, the dark-haired pair, was still in sight farther down the path, heads bobbing along. The other couple had disappeared. I found the handle in the grass without any trouble. The mechanism responded, and an oblong section of turf rose up. It was the stair I had, not the elevator, but that was all right. I ran down the steps and into the first door I saw and was in the top floor lounge, an oval room lit with diffused, simulated sunlight from above. The furniture was all comfortably bloated, sprawling, ugly. The carpet was deep and there was a fresh flower scent in the air. The blonde was over at the near end with her back to me, studying the auto chef keyboard. She was half out of her play suit. She pushed it the rest of the way down and stepped out of it, then turned and saw me. She was surprised again. She hadn't thought I might follow her down. I looked her over and told her a few uncomplimentary things about herself. She trembled but didn't answer. On an impulse, I leaned over and dialed the auto chef to hot cheese sauce. I cut the safety out of circuit and put the quantity dial all the way up. I dialed soup tureen and then punch bowl. The stuff started to come out in about a minute, steaming hot, and I took the tureens and splashed them up and down the wall on either side of her. Then when the first punch bowl came out, I used the empty bowls as scoops. I clotted the carpet with the stuff. I made streamers of it all along the walls and dumped puddles into what furniture I could reach. Where it cooled, it would harden. And where it hardened, it would cling. I wanted to splash it across her body, but it would have hurt. And we couldn't have that. The punch bowls of hot sauce were still coming out of the auto chef, crowding each other around the vent. Then I punched cancel, and then sauterne, sweet California. The wine came out well chilled in open bottles, and I took the first one and had my arm back, just about to throw a nice line of the stuff right across her midriff when a voice said behind me, "Watch out for the cold wine." My arm twitched, and a little stream of the wine splashed across her thighs. She was ready for it. Her eyes had opened at the voice, and she barely jumped. I whirled around, fighting mad. The man was standing there where he'd come out of the stairwell. He was thinner in the face than most, bronzed, wide-chested, with alert blue eyes. If it hadn't been for him, I knew it would have worked. The blonde would have mistaken the chill splash for a scalding one. I could hear the scream in my mind, and I wanted it. I took a step toward him, and my foot slipped. I went down clumsily, wrenching one knee. I got up shaking and tight all over. I wasn't in control of myself, and I screamed, You! And then I turned and got one of the punch bowls and lifted it in both hands, heedless of how the hot sauce was slopping over onto my wrists. And I had it almost in the air toward him when the sickness took me, that damned buzzing in my head, louder, louder, drowning everything out. When I came to, they were both gone. Going down in the elevator, I almost blacked out again. The blonde and the thin man weren't in any of the second-floor bedrooms. I made sure of that, and then I emptied the closets and bureau drawers onto the floor, dragged the whole mess into one of the bedrooms and stuffed the tub with it, then turned on the water. I tried the third floor, maintenance and storage. It was empty. I turned the furnace on and set the thermostat up as high as it would go. I disconnected all the safety circuits and alarms, opened the freezer doors and dialed them to defrost. I propped the stairwell door open and went back up in the elevator. On the second floor, I stopped long enough to open the stairway door there, and the water was halfway toward it, creeping across the floor, and then searched the top floor. No one was there. I opened book reels and threw them unwinding across the room. I would have done more, but I could hardly stand. I got up to the surface and collapsed on the lawn. That furry pit swallowed me up dead and drowned. While I slept, water poured down the open stairwell and filled the third level. Thawing food packages floated out into the rooms. Water seeped into wall panels and machine housings. Circuits shorted and fuses blew. The air conditioning stopped, but the pile kept heating. The water rose. Spoiled food, floating supplies, grimy water surged up the stairwell. The second and first levels were bigger and would take longer to fill, but they'd fill. Rugs, furnishings, clothing. All the things in the house would be waterlogged and ruined. Probably the weight of so much water would shift the house, rupture water pipes and other fluid intakes. It would take a repair crew more than a day just to clean up the mess. The house itself was done for, not repairable. The blonde and the thin man would never live in it again. Serve them right. The dolls could build another house. They built like beavers. There was only one of me in the world. The earliest memory I have is of some woman, probably the crush mother, staring at me with an expression of shock and horror. Just that. I've tried to remember what happened directly before or after, but I can't. Before, there's nothing but the dark formless shaft of no memory that runs back to birth. Afterward, the big calm. From my fifth year, it must have been, to my 15th, everything I can remember floats in a pleasant, dim sea. Nothing was terribly important. I was languid and soft. I drifted. Waking merged into sleep. In my 15th year, it was the fashion in love play for the young people to pair off for months or longer. Loving steady, we called it. I remember how the older people protested that it was unhealthy, but we were all normal juniors and nearly as free as adults under the law. All but me. The first steady girl I had was named Ellen. She had blonde hair, almost white, worn long. Her lashes were dark, her eyes pale green. Startling eyes. They didn't look as if they were looking at you. They looked blind. In our group, a pairing that broke up sooner than 4 weeks was a little suspect. You know, there must be something wrong with one partner or both, or the pairing would have lasted longer. 4 weeks and a day after Ellen and I made our pairing, she told me she was breaking it off. I thought I was ready, but I felt the room spin half around me till the wall came against my palm and stopped. The room had been in use as a hobby chamber. There was a rack of plasticraft knives under my hand. I took one without thinking, and when I saw it, I thought, I'll frighten her. And I saw the startled, half-angry look in her pale eyes, and I went toward her. But this is curious. She wasn't looking at the knife. She was looking at my face. The elders found me later with the blood on me and put me into a locked room. Then it was my turn to be frightened because I realized for the first time that it was possible for a human being to do what I had done. And if I could do it to Ellen, I thought, surely they could do it to me. But they couldn't. They set me free. They had to. And it was then I understood that I was the king of the world. The sky was turning clear violet when I woke up, and shadow was spilling out from the hedges. I went down the hill until I saw the ghostly blue of photon tubes glowing in the big oblong just outside the commerce area. I went that way by habit. Other people were lining up at the entrance to show their books and be admitted. I brushed past them, seeing the shocked faces and feeling their bodies flinch away, and I went into the robing chamber. Straps, aqualungs, masks, and flippers were all for the taking. I stripped, dropping the clothes where I stood and put the underwater equipment on. Then I strode out to poolside, monstrous like a being from another world. I adjusted the lung and the flippers and slipped into the water. Underneath, it was all crystal blue, with the forms of swimmers sliding through it like pale angels. Schools of small fish scattered as I went down. My heart was beating with a painful joy. Down, far down, I saw a girl slowly undulating through the motions of sinuous underwater dance, writhing around and around a ribbed column of imitation coral. She had a suction-tipped fish lance in her hand, but she wasn't using it. She was only dancing, dancing all by herself down at the bottom of the water. I followed. Around her and around I swam, stiff-legged, first more childlike and awkward than she, and then subtly parodying her motions and then improving on them until I was dancing an intricate mocking dance around her. I saw her eyes widen, and she matched her rhythm to mine then, and together, apart, together again, we coiled the wake of our dancing. At last exhausted, we clung together where a bridge of plastic coral arched over us. Her cool body was in the bend of my arm, between two thicknesses of vitrin, a world away. Her eyes were friendly and kind. There was a moment when two strangers, yet one flesh, we felt our souls speak to one another across the abyss of matter. It was a truncated embrace. We could not kiss, we could not speak, but her hands lay confidingly on my shoulders and her eyes looked into mine. That moment had to end. She gestured towards the surface and left me. I followed her up. I was feeling drowsy and almost at peace after my sickness. I thought, I don't know what I thought. We rose together at the side of the pool. She turned to me, removing her mask, and her smile stopped and melted away. She looked at me with horrified disgust, wrinkling her nose. "Bleh," she said, and turned awkward in her flippers. And watching her, I saw her fall into the arms of a white-haired man, and I heard her hysterical voice tumbling over itself. "But don't you remember?" the man's voice rumbled. "You should know it by heart." And he turned. "Hal, is there a copy of it in the clubhouse?" A murmur answered him, and in a few moments a young man came out holding a slender brown pamphlet. I knew that pamphlet. I could even have told you what page the white-haired man opened it to, what sentences the girl was reading as I watched. I waited. I don't know why. I heard her voice rising. To think that I let him touch me. And the white-haired man reassured her, the words rumbling too low to hear. I saw her back straighten. She looked across at me. Only a few yards in that scented, blue-lit air, a world away. And folded up the pamphlet into a hard wad, threw it, and turned on her heel. The pamphlet landed almost at my feet. I touched it with my toe and opened it to the page I'd been thinking of. Sedation until his 15th year, when for sexual reasons it became no longer practicable. While the advisors and medical staff hesitated, he killed a girl of the group by violence. The solution finally adopted was threefold. One, a sanction. The only sanction possible to our humane, permissive society. Excommunication. Not to speak to him, touch him willingly, or acknowledge his existence. Two, a precaution. Taking advantage of a mild predisposition to epilepsy, a variant of the so-called Cusco analog technique was employed to prevent by an epileptic seizure any future act of violence. Three, a warning. A careful alteration of his body chemistry was effected to make his exhaled and exuded wastes emit a strongly pungent and offensive odor. In mercy, he himself was rendered unable to detect the smell. Fortunately, the genetic and environmental accidents which combined to produce this atavism have been fully explained and can never again... The words stopped meaning anything, as they always did at that point. I didn't want to read any farther. It was all nonsense anyway. I was the king of the world. I got up and went away, out into the night, blind to the dulls who thronged the rooms that passed. Two squares away was the commerce area. I found a clothing outlet and went in. I pulled out clothing in handfuls till I got a set that would fit me. I bathed and changed and then went prowling in the big multi-outlet down the avenue. All those places are arranged pretty much alike, no matter what the local managers do to them. I went straight to the knives and picked out three in graduated sizes down to the size of my fingernail. Then I had to take my chances. I tried the furniture department, where I had had good luck once in a while, but this year all they were using was metal. I had to have seasoned wood. It didn't take me long. Down in the woodshop section of all places, I found some antiques, tables and benches, all with wooden tops. While the dolls collected down at the other end of the room, pretending not to notice, I sawed off a good oblong chunk of the smallest bench and made a base for it out of another. As long as I was there, it was a good place to work, and I could eat and sleep upstairs, so I stayed. I knew what I wanted to do. It was going to be a man sitting with his legs crossed and his forearms resting down along his calves. His head was going to be tilted back and his eyes closed, as if he were turning his face up at the sun. In 3 days, it was finished. The trunk and limbs had a shape that was not man and not wood, but something in between, something that hadn't existed before I made it. Beauty, that was the old word. I'd carved one of the figure's hands hanging loosely and the other one curled shut. There had to be a time to stop and say it was finished. I took the smallest knife, the one I had been using to scrape the wood smooth, and cut away the handle and ground down what was left of the shaft to a thin spike. Then I drilled a hole into the wood of the figurine's hand in the hollow between thumb and curled finger. I fitted the knife blade in there. In the small hand, it was a sword. I cemented it in place. Then I took the sharp blade and stabbed my thumb and smeared the blade. I hunted most of that day and finally found the right place. A niche in an outcropping of striated brown rock in a little triangular half-wild patch that had been left where two roads forked. Nothing was permanent, of course, in a community like this that might change its houses every 5 years or so to follow the fashion, but this spot had been left to itself for a long time. It was the best I could do. I had the paper ready. It was one of a batch I had printed up a year ago. The paper was treated, and I knew it would stay legible a long time. I hid a little photo capsule in the back of the niche and ran the control wire to a staple in the base of the figurine. I put the figurine down on top of the paper and anchored it lightly to the rock with two spots of all cement. I had done it so often that it came naturally. I knew just how much cement would hold the figurine steady against a casual hand, but yield to one that really wanted to pull it down. Then I stepped back to look, and the power and the pity of it made my breath come short and tears start to my eyes. Reflected light gleamed fitfully on the dark stained blade that hung from his hand. He was sitting alone in that niche that closed him in like a coffin. His eyes were shut, his head tilted back as if he were turning his face up to the sun. But only rock was over his head. There was no sun for him. Up the other side of the hollow, there was a terrace. And on that terrace, half an hour ago, I had seen a brief flash of color. A boy's head with a red cap on it moving past and out of sight. That was why I had to stay. I was thinking how that boy might come down from his terrace and into my road, and passing the little wild triangle of land, see my figurine. I was thinking he might not pass by indifferently, but stop and go closer to look and pick up the wooden man and read what was written on the paper underneath. I believed that sometime it had to happen. I wanted it so hard that I ached. My carvings were all over the world, wherever I had wandered. There was one in Congo City, carved of ebony, dusty black, one in Cyprus of bone, one in New Bombay of shell, one in Changte of jade. They were like signs printed in red and green in a colorblind world. Only the one I was looking for would ever pick one of them up and read the message I knew by heart. To you who can see, the first sentence said, I offer you a world. There was a flash of color up on the terrace. I stiffened. A minute later, here it came again from a different direction. It was the boy, clambering down the slope, brilliant against the green, with his red, sharp-billed cap like a woodpecker's head. I held my breath. He came toward me through the fluttering leaves, ticked off by pencils of sunlight as he passed. He was a brown boy I could see at this distance with a serious thin face, his ears stuck out, flickering pink with the sun behind them, and his elbow and knee pads made him look knobby. He reached the fork in the road and chose the path on my side. I huddled into myself as he came nearer. Let him see it. Let him not see me, I thought fiercely, and my fingers closed around a stone. He was nearer now, walking jerkily with his hands in his pockets, watching his feet mostly. When he was almost opposite me, I threw the stone. It rustled through the leaves below the niche in the rock. The boy's head turned. He stopped staring. I think he saw the figurine then. I'm sure he saw it. He took one step.
Lisa,
came floating down from the terrace, and he looked up. I saw the woman's head, tiny at the top of the terrace. She called something I didn't hear. I was standing up tight with anger. Then the wind shifted. It blew from me to the boy. He whirled around, his eyes big, and clapped a hand to his nose.
Oh, what a stench,
he said. And he turned to shout to his mother. Then he was gone, hurrying back up the road into the unstable blur of green. My own chance ruined. He would have seen the image, I knew, if it hadn't been for that damned woman. And the wind shifting. They were all against me. People, wind, and all. And the figurine still sat, blind eyes turned up to the rocky sky. There was something inside me that told me to take my disappointment and go away from there and not come back. I knew I would be sorry. I did it anyway. Took the image out of the niche and the paper with it and climbed a slope. At the top, I heard his clear voice laughing. There was a thing that might have been an ornamental mound or the camouflaged top of a buried house. I went around it, tripping over my own feet, and came upon the boy kneeling on the turf. He was playing with a brown and white puppy. He looked up with the laughter going out of his face. There was no wind, and he could smell me. I knew it was bad. No wind. And the puppy to distract him. Everything about it was wrong. But I went to him blindly anyhow and fell on one knee and shoved the figurine at his face and said, look. He went over backwards in his hurry. He couldn't even have seen the image, except as a brown blur coming at him. He scrambled up with the puppy whining and yapping around his heels and ran for the mound. I was up after him, clawing up moist earth and grass as I rose. In the other hand, I still had the image clutched and the paper with it. A door popped open and swallowed him and popped shut again in my face. With the flat of my hand, I beat the vines around it until I hit the doorplate by accident and the door opened. I dived in, shouting, wait, and was in a spiral passage, split pearl gray winding downward. Down I went headlong and came out at the wrong door, an underground conservatory humid and hot under the yellow lights with dripping rank leaves and long rows. I went down the aisle, raging, overturning the tanks until I came to a vestibule and an elevator. Down I went again to the third level, in a labyrinth of guest rooms, all echoing, all empty. At last I found a ramp leading upward past the conservatory, and at the end of it, voices. The door was clear vitrine, and I paused on the near side of it, looking and listening. There was the boy, and a woman, old enough to be his mother, just sister or cousin, more likely, and an elderly woman in a hard chair holding the puppy. The room was comfortable and tasteless like other rooms. I saw the shock grow on their faces as I burst in. It was always the same. They knew I would like to kill them, but they never expected that I would come uninvited into a house. It was not done. There was that boy, so close I could touch him. But the shock of all of them was quivering in the air, smothering like a blanket that would deaden my voice. I felt I had to shout. "Everything they tell you is lies," I said. "See here, here, this is the truth." I had the figurine in front of his eyes, but he didn't see it. "Risa, go below," said the young woman quietly, and he turned to obey. I got in front of him again and said, "Stay, look." "Remember, Risa, don't speak," said the woman. I couldn't stand it anymore. Where the boy went, I don't know. I ceased to see him. With the image in one hand and the paper with it, I leaped at the woman. I was almost quick enough. I almost reached her. But the buzzing took me in the middle of a step, louder and louder, like the end of the world. It was the second time that week. When I came to, I was sick and too faint to move for a long time. The house was silent. They had gone, of course. The house had been defiled, having me in it. They wouldn't live here again, but would build elsewhere. My eyes blurred, and after a while I stood up and looked around at the room. The walls were hung with a gray, close-woven cloth that looked as if it would tear, and I thought of ripping it down in strips, breaking furniture, stuffing carpets and bedding into the oubliette. But I didn't have the heart for it. I was too tired. 30 years. They had given me all the kingdoms of the world and the glory thereof 30 years ago. It was more than one man alone could bear for it. 30 years. At last, I stooped and picked up the figurine and the paper that was supposed to go under it, crumpled now, with the forlorn look of a message that someone has thrown away, unread. I sighed bitterly. I smoothed it out and read the last part. "You can share the world with me. They can't stop you. Strike now. Pick up a sharp thing and stab, or a heavy thing and crush. That's all. That will make you free. Anyone can do it." Anyone. Someone. Anyone. That story was by Damon Knight. Copyright 1955 by Fantasy House Incorporated. The title, The Country of the Kind. This is Michael Hansen speaking. Technical production for MindWebs by Leslie Hilsenhoff. MindWebs comes to you from WHA Radio in Madison, a service of University of Wisconsin Extension.